supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, Moving Day is happening all over college campuses right now. Today's freshman class comes with the same hopes and excitement that their predecessors have had for generations now. But today's freshman class also brings something else. 1 in 10 seeking counseling have been hospitalized for psychiatric reasons. 1 in 3 have seriously considered suicide. And every year, the number of young adults reporting significant anxiety disorders is increasing. Well, are college counseling centers able to meet what has become an increasing demand for more complex services? Well, here with me today to discuss this from Penn State is Dr. Ben Locke. He's the executive director of the Center for Collegiate Mental Health. Dr. Locke, welcome to the show.
I'll be with you.
We also have here in the studio Dr. David Rubenstein. He's the Associate Vice President for Student Wellness at Rowan. David, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Good to be with you again. Our number here is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Let's start with you, Ben Locke. Your survey covers 10 years. Who did you ask, and what trends did you find? Just kind of an overview, okay?
Okay. Yeah, so this project you're referring to, the Center for Collegiate Mental Health, it's actually not a survey. It is data that is gathered from college students seeking mental health services at their local campus. We have about 300 institutions that participate, and the most recent report available, the 2014 report, summarizes data contributed from about 150 institutions during the last academic year. And what was unique about this year's report is that we had 5 years of data coming from these same sources where we could look at trends over time.
And who were you asking?
Well, so this project's a little bit unique, and I'll just take a quick moment to describe it. Essentially, what the Center for Collegiate Mental Health, CCMH, does is we work with counseling centers around the country to standardize the information that they gather from college students when they're seeking mental health services.
So your information, the people you're interviewing, are the ones that are already seeking services.
Right. So we, CCMH, are not doing the interviewing. The students are seeking services at a local counseling center, and in that process, they answer a series of questionnaires that are part of routine mental health services.
So,
and then in turn, that routine data is contributed back to us, and then we can examine it at a very large national level.
So just a cliff notes, a broad global statement. What kind of trends did you find?
Well, there are lots of trends of interest. Some areas of mental health concerns are going up, some are going down, some are relatively flat. A couple that have been relatively stable over time is the percentage of students, for example, who have been in counseling before. What we're seeing nationally within counseling centers is that 1 out of 2 students coming into counseling centers have already been in treatment before. 1 out of 3 have already been on a psychiatric medication, as you mentioned before. 1 out of 10 have been hospitalized. So these are relatively stable trends, but very concerning trends just for their rate.
So I want to understand this. These have been stable over the years.
Over the last 5 years of data that we have, right?
Huh, and not increasing.
No, not increasing. They may be increasing slightly, but there are other types of data that we gather that appear to be showing a change over time. So, for example, the percentage of students who report having injured themselves on purpose, quote-unquote self-injury, appears to be increasing fairly steadily over the last 5 years of data. The number of students who say they have seriously considered attempting suicide appears to be increasing steadily over about the last 5 years.
That's quite disturbing. Any ideas about why?
Well, there's lots and lots of competing theories for the general growth in prevalence and severity of mental health concerns on campus. But in terms of those two data points, self-injury is an increasingly common behavior by adolescents and college students, usually in response to overwhelming emotions or difficulty coping. In the 1980s, self-injury was really only found in the confines of borderline personality disorder. Today, it's actually much more common, largely as a result of its inclusion in books and movies and common discourse. And similarly, the seriously considered attempting suicide seems to be the increasing acceptance with which students give voice to ideas of ending their lives as a way of expressing their distress.
Yeah, I wonder why it's increasing. David Rubenstein, let's bring you into this conversation. Do you have any thoughts about why our kids are hurting themselves in increasing numbers?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. That's something, as therapists, we're always trying to get to the bottom of. And I think that there are, you know, there can be a lot of different reasons for that. You know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, usually, typically, individuals are self-injuring is an effort to try and cope with really what is happening and what is going on in their life that just feels unmanageable. So the good news is that they're actually trying to cope with something. Now, it's not, of course, it's not the kind of coping strategy that we want to see, but I think that also related to that, the good news is that when they come into treatment, they're coming in and they're asking for support. They're asking for help.
Those are the ones that are coming in, though.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess I'll turn back to you, Ben Locke. There's no way of knowing about those young people who are not coming in. There's no way of finding out what's going on there.
Well, there have been lots of surveys done of the general student body, national multi-site surveys. And what they consistently find is that the percentage of students reporting these types of concerns is dramatically lower in the general population of students than it is among those seeking mental health services. So there is some information there, but I think probably more to your point is that most universities expend a great deal of effort these days to quickly identify students who may have these concerns or who may be at risk, and to proactively coordinate a response focused on their safety and well-being.
So I'm listening to these numbers of students and the severity of the disorders they present with. And so, you know, I did a little bit of homework here, and a mid-sized university like Rowan, David, your school, is about 12,000 undergraduates, or my alma mater, Temple, has nearly 30,000 graduates. We're talking about counseling centers being strained terribly. David, yours?
Yeah, sure. So every year, at least, you know, the last 7 years that I've been there, we've seen more and more students coming in for counseling services. And certainly there's been a lot of demand on the need for increasing services. The good news at Rowan is that there's been a lot, you know, we have more than doubled the number of counselors that we have on our staff. So there's a lot of administrative support, you know, from the Dean of Students and our cabinet on. And related to that, you know, we traditionally had our counseling center and our student health center, our drug and alcohol services, all in separate places across the campus. And now we have them all in one building in a wellness center, which is absolutely terrific because it means that students come in. It does several things. And by the way, there are classrooms in this wellness center too. So it destigmatizes the ability to access services. So you could have a student that is in the classroom taking a history class, and if they're not feeling well, whether it's like the flu or something like that, or perhaps they've been feeling more down in the dumps lately and they're just not sure what's going on, or any number of different things, and it's easy to walk 15 feet over to the Student Health Center or in that same building to our counseling center or to access drug and alcohol services. And it's absolutely terrific because just because it's easy to access those services, and of course now that we have more counselors, we're able to provide more services. And, you know, I suspect that this trend is absolutely just going to continue. And we have more students that more students coming into college just because there's more access to attending universities. So you have larger numbers and more mental health issues that are going on. And so it's an effort to try and meet the demand. And, you know, the good news is it's nice to have some support behind that.
Well, that's a critical issue. Let me reintroduce both of you. We're talking with Drs. Ben Locke and David Rubenstein about what's happening on college campuses today with mental health. And, you know, Dr. Locke's done an extensive survey, he and his team, about what's going on with young people who are reporting for counseling. Our number here is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you've got a young person going to school, or if you are in college and you're on a break, you haven't left yet, or if you're in local school, give us a call. 888-477-9499. I want to ask a quick question of you, Ben Locke, before we go to the phones. And you know, David said that he's got a lot of support from administration from top to bottom, and he was able to increase his staff. Is that true nationally? What's the trend, and how are counseling centers holding up?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the overall trend nationally is toward increasing services wherever possible, but an equally consistent trend is the lack of funding at many institutions to hire those new staff members. Money has to come from somewhere within a limited budget. What the trend that we see pretty clearly is that smaller institutions, usually smaller than, say, 7,500 students, do a very good job of hitting a target ratio of students to mental health staff. When you start to grow beyond that 7,500 number, you increasingly see schools struggling to meet a good ratio of staff to students. And the bigger the school, the more demands there are competing for those dollars, and that may be part of it. The other trend that we tend to see is that public institutions, community colleges, tend to struggle more with prioritizing funding for these services than private schools.
Yeah, they probably have less resources.
Usually, yeah.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Tom on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb. How are you?
Good, thanks. What can we do for you, Tom?
I'm just calling in as a young person. I'm a couple of years out of college now, but when I was in university, I took advantage of mental health counseling. I'd been counseling before, but found it to be very, very rewarding. You know, really found a mentor in my therapist, really, you know, worked through a lot of things. I would speak before to what we were talking about cutting. I still work in the social work world with young people, many of whom are preparing for college. I think one of the things that makes cutting appealing is that it is, you know, it's something that's easy to hide. You know, we can often feel like, you know, we're so overwhelmed. And I would just speak to that stigma that I think is still very present in the mental health world overall, but especially in college. You know, and what you and what other folks think about how we can remove that stigma. You know, I agree that these are services that are more accessible at many universities. I think we do need to devote more funding to them. But how to really make sure students know, it's okay, it's even good to say, I need help.
Gee, Tom, I was hoping there would be less stigma in younger generations. I mean, they do seem to be smarter than the older generation.
Yeah.
Tom,
yeah, I mean, I think I think there's less, but I think it's still very present. You know, I just watched a great film about a young person. It's an older film. It's based on a book called It's Kind of a Funny Story. And I think that addresses some of the stigma that's still there for high school and university students.
I appreciate that. David's going to react to that and about the stigma issue. I really appreciate your call, Tom, and sharing some of your history. It's really important to know.
Yeah, that issue of stigma is really huge, and that's something that we try and pay so much attention to, is how we can change and increase the atmosphere on our campus in a way that invites students to ask for help, to access the support they need. And so aside from the Wellness Center and trying to put all of these services in one place with classrooms, which has helped, we just started this new program. We're really excited. We just started it at the very end of the semester, and it's been done at some different universities throughout the country. I think Cornell started it, but it's called Let's Talk. And it's a program in which we have a counselor in five different buildings across the campus, like academic buildings. So not traditionally what you would think of as a counseling psychological services center. So what's terrific about that is, say, you could have the student that is leaving the student center, or, say, the rec center, or the engineering department, or any of the other academic buildings, and they know that there's a counselor that's available in that building during a specific time period that they can stop in for a quick chat. It's like a 20-minute quick consultation, and it's a nice way for students just to know, hey, they can stop in and just talk with the counselor and just get some quick support or some quick ideas about what might be going on. It's just another way to try and increase the atmosphere of support.
Well, what also strikes me is the name of your center, the Wellness Center, not the Behavioral Health Center, the mental health. It really is about wellness. Ben Locke, what's the deal with stigma nationally? Do you know any trends or anybody who's taking a look at that?
Well, yeah, stigma is very much a hot topic of research. And by and large, the indicators that I'm aware of is that stigma generally is decreasing or has decreased substantially. And it's interestingly, there's a bit of a bimodal conversation to be had here, because on the one hand, we want to continue to drop stigma as low as it can go, so anybody who might need help will seek it. And most institutions have programs very much like those that have been described to make services available, such as embedded counselors within academic settings or academic advising settings. At the same time, there is this perception, sometimes within higher education, that students have difficulty coping in situations that students might have coped with successfully years ago, and they will seek professional help in situations where previous generations might have sought less professional help, such as from a mentor or a parent or a friend. So there's this interesting conversation to be had about reducing stigma around mental health so that students get the help they need, while also trying to build coping and resilience in students so they are able to tackle their own problems and concerns in an adult manner.
Well, wouldn't that be the job of the counseling center in the first place, is to help build those resources within the students who've experienced themselves as so fragile?
Well, that's a great question. Wouldn't that be the responsibility of the counseling center? I think administrators within higher education who have to allocate budgets might argue that it should be the job of parents and schools who send their students to college to prepare them to cope with difficulties and be resilient and those kinds of things. There's a challenge, right?
Yeah.
We want to do both at the same time.
David?
Yeah, so I love the term you mentioned, resiliency, and I think actually everybody has that ownership within really promoting resiliency within students. Of course, that resiliency springs from within, but I think in a university setting, it's really a nice challenge for anything from administrators to deans of students to professors to rec center staff to the counseling center to academic advisors, and it's really it's nice when all of those different parties are playing a role in really promoting the resiliency or coping with stressors from the very mild to the very, very significant.
Yeah, we've got to take a break. There's so much more to talk about. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. So much, much more to talk about. We're talking about what happens in college these days, how more students are coming in with more stress, more behavioral health problems that require more intervention. We're talking with Dr. Ben Locke. He's from Penn State. He's the executive director of the college Center for Collegiate Mental Health. Dr. David Rubenstein's with us here in the studio. He's the Associate Vice President for Student Wellness at Rowan. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a week of our favorite interviews from the year with one featuring Toni Morrison. Her latest novel, God Help the Child, is about a dark-skinned girl born to light-skinned parents.
I hate to say it, but from the very beginning in the maternity ward, the baby embarrassed me.
Morrison will talk about her book, her life, and getting older. She's now 84. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking with Drs. Ben Locke and David Rubenstein about what's happening with our young people on campuses. And before our break, the question came up about resilience. And I wonder if you're seeing, and I'll start with you, Ben Locke, about nationally about children being less resilient than they were in previous generations.
Well, this is the topic of resilience is not something that we specifically have data on. But what I can say is that in the circles that I travel, there are lots of discussions about the critical importance of resilience for being successful in college and in life in general, and the challenge in front of higher education of fostering resilience, fostering healthy coping within students who are coming to college, who seem to have this bimodal distribution. On the one hand, we have these unbelievably capable students who carry more weight than we can possibly imagine, and they seem to just roll through very challenging times very successfully. And then on the other hand, we have a lot of students that seem to really struggle with coping with the difficulties of everyday life as you transition out of high school, a more protected, predictable environment, into the college environment, which is much more open, more flexible. And so this idea of helping students become more resilient so that they can cope on their own is certainly an area of hot interest right now in higher ed.
David?
Yeah, it's interesting. I can't think of any other age period between the ages of 18 and 25 where you have so many different transitions happening at one point. So you have kids coming on to college and they're renegotiating their relationships with their friends. They're making new friendships. They're renegotiating their relationships with their parents. Their parents are renegotiating their relationships with them. They're trying to figure out what to do with 24 hours of their day. How much are they going to study? How much are they going to eat? What are they going to eat? How much are they going to sleep? When are they going to sleep? All of those kinds of things. And so it's an interesting and important challenge of really growing up. And one of the things that we look at in terms of resiliency is what coping strategies have worked well in the past and what areas have they struggled with. And it's interesting because in the parent orientation in the summer, prior to when kids come to campus, we have a conversation with the parents about just that. In other words, as they prepare their son or daughter for college, to start to have the conversation and to think about where are their areas of strength. You know, what do they do really well with? And then what area do they have some trouble with? And it's probably going to be those same themes that repeat themselves as they come into college. And what kinds of things can they do now to prepare for those challenges, whether it's asking for additional support, or perhaps it's just more openly talking between a parent and their son or daughter about what lies ahead?
Let's go to the phones. We've got Shani on the line. Hi, Shani.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. What can we do for you?
So I'm actually a student at Rowan University, and I receive mental health services there. I suffer from depression and anxiety, and specifically what you were speaking to was that I had a past of self-harm. I really wanted to thank Rowan for its great handling of this, but I know a huge problem on campus is that there's still a really big waiting list. And I was wondering how students who are still on the waiting list can help seek support and, cope with their difficulties.
That's a great question. But before we shift away, can I ask you a couple questions, Shani?
Sure.
Was it difficult for you to go to counseling, or did you know about your history of depression when you
coming were in? I knew about my history, and the first thing I did when I got to campus was seeking help. But I did have a little bit of a difficult transition coming into my second semester. I had to be hospitalized, and it took about a month after I was released from the hospital between that and being able to receive care on campus again. And that was really problematic because while I coped appropriately with that, I was really scared for other students who had to deal with the same problem.
Oh, my God, of all times to have to wait before counseling. So now I understand your question. It's not theoretical. It's personal. We've got just the guy.
We want
to ask that question.
You know, that has been the challenge that's been in front of us at the university for some time, and we've tried to address that in a couple of different ways. One is, of course, increasing the counseling center's staff so we're able to, as quickly as we can, work with students. The other is just the program I was talking about earlier, the Let's Talk program, is trying to put counselors in, say, non-traditional settings to try and reach out to students sooner and earlier and perhaps give them what they need so it doesn't necessarily get to the point where they need to come in for formal counseling. But I totally hear you on that. That's quite the challenge in terms of wait list with more students coming in and needing services and trying to meet the student needs and doing the very best, whether it's increasing the resources or increasing the kinds of programs that are able to reach out to kids sooner and earlier.
Shani, thanks so much for your call. And this is a really important question here. You've got kids out there, and I'm not talking to you, David. I mean, I'm talking to Ben and everybody you surveyed. You've got kids that need services that are waiting. So I'll start with you, David. You've got deep pockets now. What are you going to change? What do you need? do you need to take better care of these kids?
I'm hoping for deeper pockets. But we've come certainly a long way, which has been terrific in terms of increasing the staffing. And The other thing that we're trying to do is our on-call. We have a 24/7 on-call service, and we have, you know, of course, someone that's on-call during the day in person. And we're trying to have those people that are on-call at different points of the day in which we see a higher volume, and different days of the week when we see more volume. In addition, aside from resourcing and scheduling, the other thing is we've really looked hard at our programming and have spent some time developing and innovating in more groups. So in other words, we have this new program that's starting up this fall that's called Empower Hour. And the whole idea behind that is to allow students to come in and have an opportunity to develop coping strategies in a whole number of different areas, whether it's stress management or anxiety or depression or interpersonal skills or self-injury, what have you. And it gives them a chance to come in and develop some coping strategies that hopefully address those stressors as early on as possible. I think the other issue, too, and this is important, is that to make sure that you have staff that are providing services that really meet the needs of students. You know, we spent more time developing our LGBTQIA services. We have a formal dialectical behavior therapy program for students with self-injury is going on. As I said, developing more groups and different kinds of groups, putting counselors in different areas. All of these kinds of services and programs and resources are really trying to do the best we really can with what resources that we have to reach out to students, to meet them where they're at, and to give them what we're able to while continue to ask and develop our resources as we go year by year.
Ben Luck, I could imagine most heads of counseling departments around the country would say exactly the same thing that David just said.
Yeah, I think you would hear very similar answers. And so, you know, I think many of the things that David has listed are very, very innovative and are exactly what counseling centers are doing to try to offer a variety of levels of care. And one of the things I think is helpful to understand when thinking about mental health services is that there are kind of two very different roles that mental health centers play on campus, and the concept of a waiting list typically only comes to play in one of them. One of the roles that mental health centers play, both on campus and in the community, is that of a crisis response or emergent response mechanism. So a student is in crisis today, and they are seen today within 30 minutes or an hour and assessed for what their needs are for stabilization, safety planning, and possibly hospitalization. And that's a very distinct role. It is time limited. It is stabilization, safety planning for today, maybe this week. The other role is more of a treatment role. So how many students can we treat in an ongoing manner? And that is where you tend to encounter waiting lists. So the availability of treatment, the number of counselors, the number of treatment slots that are available can simply become full. And if your institution is located near a city, then you may have lots of additional options for, let's say, private pay health insurance. And institutions are being very innovative by designing multiple layers of treatment that are, you know, structured short-term or group or workshops or drop-in. And all of these are helpful, but still you end up in this scenario where at some point every available slot for quote-unquote treatment is full, and that puts folks coming out of the crisis response in a difficult position, both the students and the providers.
I wonder, and I'll turn this to you, David, what's the impact on the counselors?
Yeah, well, great question. So it's funny because we have a retreat every year, and the same theme comes up every year. It has to do with really self-care within the wellness center, the counselors trying to take trying to develop innovative programs within the wellness center where counselors can take good care of themselves. And that tries to, you know, we try and do as much as we can in terms of ongoing communication during our staff meetings weekly around how we're all doing with what's going on. And and trying to figure out ways to take care of ourselves individually and as a staff. And that looks differently for the different therapists and different counselors and also for the counseling center.
Yeah. Oh, get less theoretical here.
Yeah.
When you say that looks differently for the different staff, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So what do they need and what do they get?
Yeah, sure. So, well, the good news is, so we have the staff at the Counseling Center has a lot of varied interest and expertise. So, you know, you could have a staff member doing some mindfulness exercises during different parts of the day for counselors that might be interested. You have another staff that is very interested in art and art therapy, and so there's opportunities for that. You have staff that are interested in music. So there's a lot of different things that we do over the course of a semester, depending on how things are going and what people need. You know, and back to that DBT group for a second, you know.
Well, you're going too fast with these letters here.
Yeah. Sorry, the Dialectical Behavior Therapy Group, you know, that's a consultation team for the therapist. And that's probably one of the best things that we've done because it allows the counselors to get together for an hour and a half every week. And part of that is designed to the team, the counselors giving support to each other around difficult stuff.
Well, we've got to take a short break, but I just want to give you some advice, David, if I may, about how to care best for your counselors. I think you ought to pack up the whole system and take them down to Disney World. Let them all wear silly ears, and then they'll come back getting more ready to work. Just one man's opinion.
Okay, all right.
That sounds great.
Yeah, you can come too, Ben.
Oh, great.
I'm sure I'll be hearing from that when I get back.
So like I said, we've got to take a short break. We're talking with Ben Locke, who's the executive director of the Center for Collegiate Mental Health at Penn State. David Rubenstein is associate vice president for student wellness at Rowan University, and that's exactly what we're talking about. We'd love to hear your thoughts, your experiences. Our number is 888-477-9499. Once again, 888-477-9499. If you are receiving counseling on a college campus, or if you did, or if your child is, we'd love to hear from you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
For three decades, Dr. Dan Gottlieb has hosted thoughtful discussions on behavioral health on WHYY. Celebrate 30 years of Voices in the Family at a special event with Dr. Dan and friends at WHYY, Tuesday, September 8th. More at whyy.org/events.
I'm Jeremy Hobson with the immigration debate front and center. Who is coming to America?
In 1960, 75% of the foreign-born population was from Europe, and only 12% were from Asia. And today, only 12% are from Europe, and 30% are from Asia, and about 54% from Latin America.
Immigration by the numbers. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Support WHYY and see results with an on-air message. There's less noise than you'll find everywhere else, so your message will stand out and be heard. Call Roseanne Olin at 215-351-1223 or visit whyy.org/underwriting.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about college campuses and what's happening to students and what we are doing for students. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Michael on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how's everybody doing today?
Good. How about you, Michael?
I'm all right. It's kind of ironic that you're talking about this today because I just recently, I actually go to Rowan University myself. I just recently came out to my mother and told her that I believe that I have depression, and it's been an ongoing feeling that I've had for a while, and I was really embarrassed to come out to anybody and try to face this problem. So far, I've failed a bunch of courses because of a lack of motivation and other factors. I was wondering what colleges are doing to kind of outreach to those who might have mental disabilities or mental health issues that that they're too embarrassed to talk about the outreach, because I haven't been contacted by anybody since I failed my last two classes at Rowan. I feel like there's kind of a disconnect between the colleges and the people who are too afraid to come out with their mental health issues.
You said you have not been contacted. Who would you like to contact you, and why?
Well, that's the thing, is I've never had any mental health issues, really, to have that experience of outreaching myself to other people. I feel that because I failed my last two classes, I kind of just disappeared from my classes, honestly. Halfway through, I lost the motivation. I almost couldn't get out of bed. I don't live on campus. I commute. But nobody's really contacted me for anything, not just for like an outreach for my mental health state, but nobody's come out and said, hey, is something wrong? You failed your courses. That's a problem. I feel like it hasn't been addressed.
So you would have preferred somebody to reach out to you first.
And yeah, because I, honestly, even now talking with you on a faceless, radio program, I'm shaking. I'm embarrassed to talk about this. And
in
the past few days.
Let me see what I can do to help you with that. With that embarrassment, I want to tell you my first most significant episode of clinical depression happened when I was in my 30s, and I'm a mental health professional. I didn't quite know what was going on with me, but I do know my mind felt different, for lack of a better word, crazy, and I was ashamed of what might come out of my mouth. I was ashamed of who I was. I was ashamed I was going to be discovered as being defective. And so I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed about me. People think depression is just a depressed mood, but it's all-consuming. And when you're talking about your mind being altered, it's going to be embarrassing and shameful. So, Michael, I know what the experience is. I know what you went through. I know what you're going through. And there's thousands and millions of us who also know that. So I just wanted to connect with you on that level. Just human,
I appreciate
human
that.
To human. So, all right, David, you wanted to respond to Mike.
Yeah,
it's
I'm sorry to
question.
Hear. Yeah, it sounds like just a very, very really hard experience. One of the things that we realized too at Rowan, in terms of, we have a department, it's called the Academic Advising Department, and I think we realized we really wanted to reach out to students quicker that were having academic trouble, to reach out to them. And I think that's an area where we've also actually hired more academic advisors over the course of the last year and a half. And I'm so sorry you've had that experience, and maybe there's a way for us to we can somehow get connected. You could email me, what have you, and we can see what, get you the support that you need. But that's a big issue, because actually those academic stressors are way high up there for kids that are coming to college for the first time or returning, and resulting in significant anxiety and depression. And I think that's been another important challenge of how to reach out to kids that are really having trouble academically, just like you were talking about, that no one knew what was going on, and it was tough to think about how you could get some support. So I hear you on that, and we're trying to develop those programs to kind of address that. We have a Healthy Campus Initiatives office that's actually also geared towards students, that gives them an opportunity to come in and talk about really whatever is going on. And we have students that come in that they could be experiencing just the kind of thing that you're talking about, and that's a segue into the counseling center. Or is it just meeting other kids that are just coping with just the daily stressors of college?
Michael, thanks so much for your call and for opening up that discussion. I want to ask you both a question, gentlemen. I guess the question is, if I am a parent of a child who's going to your center, I want to know about quality of care. Are they getting good services, not just services, but I want to know if they're receiving state-of-the-art treatment that's been tested. I want to know that the counselors are trained adequately and sufficiently and that they're getting good supervision. So who wants to take that? Ben? Can you?
Yeah, sure. I can jump in there. I mean, I wear two hats. I'm the clinical director at Penn State University's Counseling Center, and I run Center for Collegiate Mental Health. And I can speak to the hiring practices within counseling centers around the country are very, very much focused on hiring individuals who are competent with the correct degrees, with the correct background, and very much able to connect with students and provide effective services. And, you know, that's certainly a priority that we have here. One, you know, this past year we were able to bring real data to this question where there has been sometimes debate or accusations about maybe the services that counseling centers provide. But we were able to look at the sort of outcome data of services provided to students nationally. And we were able to show that the effect of those services, the improvement in symptoms, was equivalent to what you would see in a randomized controlled trial for a study of a particular therapeutic methodology. So not only can I say this from my personal lived experience, professional lived experience, hiring and training and working with staff in counseling centers, but also from a research perspective that the services provided are statistically have been shown to be very just as effective as other mental health services you would provide. And actually, I would say most institutions, I think, go above and beyond the typical expectations in mental health services to make sure that students get what they need and are treated in an effective and caring way.
Boy, that's sure good to know, David.
Yeah, so that's been an area. I mean, so delivering empirically supported treatment, I think that's really the question at hand. And, you know, as a parent, right, you, of course you're going to want to know that, hope that your son or daughter is getting the best treatment possible. I mean, I think as a parent, that's what's going to go through your mind. And so, you know, from Rowan's standpoint, you know, I'll just talk about the dialectical behavior therapy program. You know, once again, you know, that's a nice example of implementing a formal dialectical behavior therapy program with staff that has been formally trained. And that's just a small example. Aside from that, you know, and certainly hiring licensed staff, we have ongoing training weekly. We have our case conferences and our didactic seminars, and it's an ongoing effort towards really quality assurance and quality of improvement, both programmatically and as far as individual services that are provided, and trying to stay ahead of the curve and also be cognizant of what with any particular year, what students are presenting with, and are there themes in what they need and what we can provide.
Well, I feel better hearing that, and it's good to know. It's good to know what's going on in these campuses. Let's take another call. We've got Dr. Kenny from Reading.
Yes, good afternoon. I am the program director of a student affairs and higher education graduate program up at Kutztown University. And so I'm training graduate students who are going to be going into other aspects of student affairs, advisement, career services, residence life and housing, et cetera. And I guess what gave me pause was the last young man's question and concern about the fact that there was no follow-up by anybody from any support services on campus, like TRIO or Act 101 or any of those kinds of services on campus, in coordination with counseling services. So I guess that's my primary question. What level of collaboration is existing on campuses across the country? I know on some levels what's existing, but I want to hear from you all, what's the level of collaboration happening between college counseling centers, which are also primarily part of student affairs, and other support services on these campuses
Well, since
to avoid these kinds of things happening?
Dr. Kenny, since you're question initially was posed across the country. Let's hear Ben Locke tackle that.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I think the answer is will always be contextualized in the university that you're looking at. But as a general rule, what certainly we do here at Penn State, and what I'm aware of most of my colleagues do and as clinical directors, is that student services across the university are very tightly integrated, and that they consult and communicate on an ongoing and regular basis, especially when a student is identified who may have concerns. So a good example of that would be an incident occurs in the residence halls, and the counseling center is notified of that incident, so that if that student comes in seeking services, then we know how to be able to help. And now, you know, I think the caller was specifically talking about having failed a couple of classes and expressing concern that no one had reached out. And I think that there is a divide between academic performance and student services rendered in a proactive manner in response to academic performance. I think many students would resent that level of intrusion into their lives, while others might like it. And in some ways, we have shifted away from an in loco parentis supervisor kind of model, where you're waiting to see what's happening and responding immediately, and more towards the student is the adult, and that if they're having difficulty, the expectation is they will then reach out. It is, as a general rule, that small schools will really refine and focus their energies around these kind of coordinated response efforts, whereas much larger schools will struggle with that.
Of course, of course. So I've got to ask you, David, in just the few seconds we have left.
Yeah, sure.
We've been hearing about hard work. We've been hearing you're spread thin. You don't have the resources you need. Do you like what you do?
Oh, I love what I do. Oh, I absolutely love what I do. I think that's probably one of the best things in my life, is to realize that, you know, I was pretty young when I realized I loved doing counseling and therapy, and probably one of the best things in my life. And so I think it's a blessing for anybody to find something that they feel passionate about.
Well, our students, your students, and students around the country are fortunate that you get the services you do. I want to thank both of you, Ben Locke from Penn State, David Rubenstein of Rowan. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
Listen, to my listeners, don't forget to make a reservation for our 30th anniversary special event on Tuesday, September 8th. I'd love to see you there. We're going to be talking about the past, and we're going to be talking about the future. Check us out, whyy.org/events. Well, you can email us at voices@whyy.org. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.